In the years after the 9/11 attacks, many stories have emerged of heroism, triumph, and tragedy. But one woman's extraordinary tale of survival against the odds stands out.
I was on the South Tower, and I lost my fiancé that day.
Tanya Head's story seemed tailor-made for a country in desperate need of inspiration.
Her story is the most tragic, but yet the most triumphant of all the stories. The perfect package.
Everyone fell for Tanya Head. Politicians, the press, the families of the dead heroes who became her friends.
We took her on just complete trust and faith. You know, we had no reason not to, not to believe everything she was saying to us.
But there was a flaw in Tanya's version of that terrible September day. It would prove devastating. When the planes hit the Twin Towers on the 11th of September 2001, Tanya Head wasn't even in New York.
Holy fuck!
Oh my God! Oh my God! Jesus fucking Christ!
Patrice Blunt,
Lydia E. Bravo,
and my father, Michael Ernest Beekman.
And my father, John Patrick Bergen.
Sharon M. Falcon.
In the weeks and months after 9/11, as the nation grieved, the survivors, the ones that had got away, received little attention or sympathy. They were, after all, the lucky ones. Jerry Bogatz was lucky. He worked on the 82nd floor of the North Tower. The first plane hit nine floors higher. He managed to walk out just 4 minutes before the tower collapsed. Three members of his team were killed.
Any number of people afterwards told me, well, somebody must have been watching out for you. You get kind of all mystical in these situations. And I got angry at that. I said, well, why were they watching out for me? You know? The person 20 floors above might have been, you know, a wonderful person, you know, much better than me in a sense of value. And they had no choice. You know, they had no options, and I did. That doesn't make sense. It's completely random.
Carrie Cohen Sullivan was lucky, too. She'd only been working at the South Tower for 3 weeks when the planes hit. She survived simply because she didn't hear the announcements ordering her to stay at her desk.
I was so guilty for surviving. I was really young. All these other thousands of people are dead, but I'm still here. You know, most of it is due to luck. I worked on a low floor. I didn't stick around the area. I just left.
In the aftermath of the attacks, New York attempted to get back to some sort of normality. But many survivors were struggling to come to terms with their horrific experiences.
After a while, you can't talk about this anymore with your family. I mean, you've worn them out, you know. And your need to talk is greater than their ability to listen, you know. And a lot of times it's repetitive. It's repetitive. So sure, you talk the first couple of weeks, first couple of months, but then you feel like you just have to not talk anymore. And it's not their fault. It's just the reality of it.
Nearly 2 years later, many survivors still felt isolated and traumatized. A small group, just 9 or 10, met up in a Manhattan church hall to share their feelings.
When you were with other people in the group, there was a certain permission to talk about whatever you needed to talk about, and that they understood.
News of the meeting spread quickly. Each week, more survivors would come, desperate to share their experiences.
Come over here, and with the flashlight, we were able to get closer and closer to the voice until I heard.
We felt each other's pain, and they gave me a lot of relief. And it was great. It was really great to just be part of the group.
On 9/11, Cynthia Shepherd lost her fiancé. He died inside the North Tower. At the same time, she was delivering mail to the World Trade Center. She stood beneath the towers as bodies rained down.
In my mind, I felt they were still alive. They hurt, they felt pain before they hit. You know, I mean, I still see them just before they hit. And that's like for life.
Debris and dust, it looked like.
The group grew. Soon there were 500 survivors signed up online and meetings with over 100 people. Amongst the new members, one woman's story stood out. Tanya Head said she was on the 78th floor of the South Tower. That made her one of only 19 people at or above the point of impact who survived. But incredibly, her fiancé died in the North Tower that day. Her vivid account of miraculous escape and tragic loss captivated everyone.
I looked around and it was like a horror movie. People were mounted on top of each other, the smell of burnt skin, and people's insides was gagging. I kept thinking about my fiancé, about our wedding. I wanted to wear that white dress and swear my love for him.
It was an amazing tale. It was that her fiancé was in Tower 1 and she was in Tower 2. Her fiancé was killed. Tanya was severely injured, managed to escape the tower before it collapsed, and then wound up in a hospital with a very severely injured and burnt arm.
Something gave me the strength to get up. I believe today it was my fiancé on his way to heaven. A firefighter took me in his arms the rest of the way out. When the tower came crashing down, we found cover. And the next thing I remember is waking up in the hospital.
Of all the amazing 9/11 survival stories, Tanya Head's was unparalleled.
I saw it from the outside, and Tanya saw it from the inside. I could see the flames, I can see the people jumping, whereas she was a victim where she was on fire, she was burning, and someone saved her.
She had all the key elements from everyone else's story. I saw it, I ran from it. She saw it, ran from it, survived it, lost a husband. Everyone else had one element. She had all the elements, the perfect storm.
But the thing that impressed her fellow survivors most was how well she seemed to be coping. She'd stuck at her career in global investment and now even found time to energize the group.
She put so much effort into the Survivors Network that it always made me feel guilty that I wasn't doing more. Preparing materials, trying to do fundraisers, creating the agendas for the meetings, lining up speakers, things like that. She gave a lot of money also to the organization. She paid a lot of things out of her own pocket. I could never give as much of myself as she seemed to give. It always made me just think, you know, gosh, how can anybody be that resilient? I don't know what I would have done if that was me that had all of those things happen to them because of this one event.
Within months of joining, Tanya was helping transform the survivors group. She helped the network get official status. Next, she secured state funding. She even found a specialist trauma expert to lead therapy sessions. Al Siebert, like everyone else, found Tanya and her story irresistible.
Her right arm was scarred and burned and withered, functional, but clearly badly damaged from burns. And with that, with the look at that arm and her saying she was on the floor where some of the plane fuel came smashing and sloshing through and burning, just automatically you're going, wow, look at that. She's one of the people who's actually burned by the flames. And that just, like, you don't question that.
No one questioned Tanya Head. Within a year, she was to become 9/11's most famous living face. ...9/11 claimed 2,800 lives. But fewer than 300 complete bodies were ever recovered. The remaining victims were lost in the rubble of what became known as the Pit. In 2003, as the second anniversary loomed, the experiences of survivors were still largely ignored. They weren't even allowed access to Ground Zero, the place where they'd lost friends, colleagues, and suffered so deeply.
If we wanted to go visit Ground Zero to try to get some closure, we were not allowed access. We had to stand out around the big metal gates with all of the tourists taking their pictures and talking loudly, or stand next to the people selling the horrible tacky merchandise of, you know, the picture books of the attacks and things like that. There was no quiet place for survivors to go to be able to have some closure with the site or to say goodbye to their coworkers or anything else they lost that day.
There was an exclusion. Of course, family members should have access. That's where their loved ones died. No question. But that, of course, survivors had experiences there too, and that visiting there was something that we should be allowed to do if we chose to. So there was a real strong feeling that not being able to do that was part of the issue of how survivors were being treated in the aftermath.
So far, the survivors had got nowhere with the authorities. But on the 17th of March, Tanya sent out a concisely worded email to all members of the group. Somehow, she'd negotiated her way in.
I've arranged a visit to Ground Zero for World Trade Center survivors. During the visit, those of you who are up to it will have the opportunity to descend to the bottom of the pit. I realize many of you still find it difficult to go to the site, so please think about this carefully. Tanya.
A month later, thanks to Tanya's efforts, a small group of survivors finally got through the gates and into Ground Zero.
It was a very emotional experience going into the pit. Awesome in many ways. Healing in some ways. So there's that aspect to it. Disturbing. Different people had different reactions to it.
That was a huge step for me in my healing process because it was the first time that I could stand there and let go of some of the memories or talk about some of the memories that had happened that day. And I know a lot of other survivors that went down there on that day feel the same way, that it was a first step kind of in the closure process.
Within 6 months of joining the survivors network, Tanya had become the driving force behind the group.
People around her, they were appreciating what she was doing for them. Wow, look at how this tower survivor who was so badly scarred and damaged and lost her fiance and so forth, look how well she's doing to help all of us cope with these things. So she was acting like a good role model of being a good survivor, and people were in deep appreciation for that.
Everyone who met Tanya was struck by how strong she seemed, despite her terrible loss.
She did have a relatively sunny, pleasant disposition. She wasn't morose, she wasn't depressed, and, you know, that was in a way inspirational, like, oh, okay, it's possible to live through such horror and tragedy and still go on and, you know, have a life and be happy relatively and, you know, be who you are.
In spring 2004, the group started writers' workshops. At last, it seemed Tanya had an outlet for her sadness, and she put her grief on full display.
It's still all so raw. It hurts as much now as then, and I still cannot understand why. Why? I talked to Dave and told him I was sorry, but he didn't answer back. Our photos together are now only ghosts of a life I once had and desperately want back. My other half is missing, ripped away from us by human missiles.
Tanya Head set about creating a public audience for her inner personal turmoil. She began mass mail-outs to all 500 members of the Survivors Network, detailing her painful recovery.
Her experiences seem to be more than many of the other people who are involved in the Survivors Network. And even though we try to be egalitarian and equal, and you know, there's no question that this hierarchy of suffering does form. And the stories that we were telling didn't seem to have as much impact as what she experienced.
She would walk in and would barely make it to her seat because she would be surrounded, almost by fans.
The whole group was becoming entangled in Tanya's heartbreak. On the 23rd of March 2004, she posted the latest installment of her story. A success at work had led to a personal breakthrough.
Today I got a promotion at work and I still don't know why. Most of the times my mind is miles away. I relive over and over the moments I shared with Dave, my fiancé who died in the North Tower. After I heard about the promotion, I had this urge. I called the store where the wedding dress I never got to wear is being stored and told them to go ahead and donate it to charity. This is a big step for me. It's been accumulating dust for 2.5 years and it's time.
But as Tanya put her tragic story center stage, inconsistencies appeared. She'd told some people she'd lost a husband, others that her fiancé had died. The first doubts surfaced about Tanya's incredible tale.
On one occasion I asked her what her fiancé's last name was, because she had always referred to him as David, but had never used the last name. Part of it was curiosity, and part of it, I think, was a little bit of suspicion. And she gave me a last name. And I remember looking in the portraits of grief that they wrote after 9/11, and there he was. And I said, well, why am I even doing this? You know, I felt bad that I was even suspicious in some ways.
I just didn't want to pry, didn't want to make her feel worse. I didn't want to ask more questions. Even when you did ask questions, when she was emotional, she would still answer them. She would just, you know, continue to be emotional. It never prevented her from answering your questions. But I think it made people less willing to ask more questions.
But it wasn't just Tanya's vulnerability that made people reluctant to question her. In the 4 years since she'd been in the Survivors Network, her story had been central to their change in fortunes. And as New York prepared for the fourth anniversary of the attacks, they were finally going to take center stage, thanks to Tanya. The organizers of the new 9/11 Tribute Center had got to hear of Tanya's story. It persuaded them that survivors' accounts must be featured. On the 9th of September 2005, leading politicians opened the Tribute Center in front of the world's press.
However many hundreds of times I've been here since the attacks, there's not a time when you don't see visitors coming here who were not here that day, walking the grounds, peering at the site, trying to comprehend the story. And it's our obligation to tell that story.
Only one story summed up both the tragedy and the heroism of New York on 9/11. Tanya Head's.
Why was she chosen to give the tour to the mayor and to other dignitaries? Probably because her story is the most tragic, but yet the most triumphant of all the stories. She made it out. She helped other people along the way. And she's still carrying her head high, even though she, you know, she lost her husband and she has this permanent injury to her arm. So she's an inspiration to other people.
Michael Daly, a reporter with New York's Daily News, was among the press pack. He picked up on Tanya's striking behavior that day.
It didn't seem easy for her, or at least she seemed appropriately moved by what she was saying, and the people were listening to her, obviously very moved. She didn't seem like she was jumping all over herself to get a picture taken and all that.
So we know who we're talking to. So we start here, we say who we are. We don't, in my case, I don't say what happened.
Just a few feet off camera, listening, you know, trying to hear what was going on and what was happening. I could see that she was nervous, she was edgy. And my reading at the time was that it was because of the nature of the Tribute Center and knowing she would be the first person giving the first short tour.
The other guides will tell their story, interject what happened here that day and what happened for the future. Please.
Given the face of somebody who was there, they really connect with what happened here that day.
You feel like, you know, she's already been through so much, and here she is at the scene of this horrible thing. I mean, how much do you, as a reporter, really need to drag her through every particular?
She was a person who appeared to be using courage. She was not someone who was accustomed to speaking to groups or accustomed to being on television, and just put out of her mind that all this was here, and here are these very, very famous and important politicians all just right there, you know, a foot and a half from her face. She got through that. In a way that one could appreciate in someone who was supposedly very emotionally traumatized and damaged, who had become the poster child for the tower survivors and was like attempting to deal with the day.
That's what we're doing.
We're very proud of him. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
Sally, you did a great job.
Thank you.
You kind of sense she'd been vetted by history by that point. I mean, you figure, you know, she's not going to be with these people at Tribute giving tours at this point if it wasn't legit. Do I like writing stories that turn out not to be true? Absolutely not. Do I make every effort I can make to make the stories accurate? Yes, I do.
Late that night, Tanya emailed the network. She made no attempt to hide her delight.
For those who missed it, here's a short clip about it. Notice the amount of cameras pointing at me? And notice who I'm giving the tour to? Pataki, Bloomberg, and Giuliani. Don't ask me what I said, because I have no idea. I was freaking out. Oh my God. I was totally overwhelmed, and I had to tell my story.
People were saying, hey, that's great, you know, that's wonderful. So people were very aware of it. They were congratulating her. They thought it was a good thing.
Tanya Head was now part of the official account of 9/11. Her fame grew. So did the questions about her story. Nine months after the attacks, in May 2002, the New York Times published a definitive account of the last terrible minutes inside the Twin Towers. They claimed they interviewed everyone who'd survived from the impact floor and above in the South Tower. But now it looked like there'd been a crucial omission. Tanya Head wasn't mentioned. Across America, grieving families and friends seized on the New York Times piece for clues about their loved ones' dying moments. 40 miles upstate from Manhattan, in Upper Nyack, the Crowthers had lost their only son, Wells, in the attacks. They scoured the article for any mention of him.
I took the paper, I sat down and I read it, and sure enough, that's when
some of the survivors had started mentioning this mysterious man in the red bandana. And as soon as I read red bandana, I said, oh my God, Wells, there you are. I found you. It was like such a miracle.
And she called out to me. I was sitting in the kitchen. She was in the bedroom. She said, Jeffo, come here.
I said, here, I think I found Wells. And because Wells always carried a red bandana in his back pocket since he was 7 or 8 years old and his father first gave him a red bandana. He always carried red bandanas with him.
Wells, or Red Bandana Man, was just 24 years old when he was killed. He'd been a high school hockey champion and an enthusiastic volunteer for the local fire department. After college, he started out as a junior trader on the 105th floor of the World Trade Center.
He was doing very nicely. He enjoyed it. He was in the towers. He loved working in the towers. I remember one day he called me up, and I was at my desk in New Jersey. He said, Dad, is it raining where you are? I said, it's pouring. He said, not where I am. Sun's out. He said, I'm looking down at the clouds, however. And he thought that was just nifty. You know, he really did. He loved that concept.
After the attacks, Red Bandana Man kept coming up in the accounts of the survivors. Wells had gone back into the burning South Tower at least 3 times that morning. In all, he rescued 18 people. 9/11 had many heroes, but few like Wells Crowther. In recognition, he was the first citizen to be made an honorary member of the New York Fire Department.
He wanted to be a firefighter, and he was doing that job which he, in his heart of hearts, wanted to be doing. And it was, and for that too, I am incredibly thankful.
We are.
Yeah.
To know that.
No greater love hath one than to lay down his life for his fellow man. And he did.
Wells's story became a legend in a city struggling to rebuild itself. And as the Tribute Center tours grew in popularity, a new figure began to appear in Tanya's account. A young man with a red bandana.
When she first told me she was on the 78th floor, one of the first things I said was, did you see the man with the red bandana? And the answer was yes. She saw him. But over time that became, not only did she see him, but he put the fire out on her back. And I think possibly that he led her to the stairwell or something. So it seemed to change over time. That's what I noticed. And again, it's easy to discount that and say, well, she didn't talk about it the same way then, or I didn't hear it the right way, or, you know, whatever. But it just seemed to change over time and become more than it had been initially.
The tours at Ground Zero were now running 6 times a day, 7 days a week. Tanya's story was reaching thousands of people from around the world. In time, the parents of Red Bandana Man heard the rumors about yet another survivor who owed her life to their son.
If someone says, oh, you're the father of the man in the red bandana, yes, I was one of them. I'm delighted to meet them. To know someone else, that he was able to, you know, help and preserve their life. I mean, that's it's more of an affirmation of his life to me. So when we heard about this woman, Tanya Head, we were very excited, and we wanted to meet her.
At first, Tanya seemed reluctant. But in March 2006, she finally agreed to meet the Crowthers. Tanya insisted they meet in private at one of Manhattan's most exclusive dining clubs.
We just talked and talked, and we talked first, spoke about Wells a bit, and then she said, well, I'll tell you what happened to me, but it was like a recitation almost. You know, it was just, she started talking and just kind of recited the story.
And she said she was lying on the ground and she felt this terrible pain in her shoulder, and then she felt
someone patting,
someone hitting it, and she was, you know, stop. She said, stop, that hurts. But it was Wells putting out the flames.
And she saw him when she turned wearing the red bandana.
She said, and I looked at his face and I saw those beautiful brown eyes. She said, I have his picture in every room in my house so I can see his eyes every time, every room I'm in. He's always there with me. She's telling us this. And I was very touched, you know.
So, you know, it was...
And she was going to take a piece of that clothing because she said that was the last thing that he had touched. And she was going to have it put into a plaque, like under a piece of glass or something, or lucite or something like that, and present that to us. She never did.
We took her on just complete trust and faith. You know, we had no reason not to,
yeah,
not to believe everything she was saying to us.
In October 2006, Tanya Head was voted president by members of the Survivors Network. But there were growing concerns about the new leader.
When she walked in the room, there was an arrogance about her, and I thought she was pretty pompous. And so was the person that she was with. But I could tell the other person was the follower, and Tanya was the leader. You know, we weren't there for fun and games. We weren't there for glory. I was so turned off by that. I fulfilled my obligations, did my tours, and I resigned.
Most of the group, though, remained in awe of their new president and how well she coped. Like Tanya, Cynthia was traumatized after losing her fiancé in the North Tower.
She just continued to work and continued to help the survivors, and she was there for everyone. So I just felt that rather than to just keep the pain bottled up, I would have been able to like talk to her about it, and she could have helped me relieve some of the pain that I felt.
Tanya usually went out of her way to help other survivors. This time she seemed strangely reluctant.
Okay, she said we're going to talk, but we never spoke. And it was like a total avoidance. I felt like I was being avoided by her, and I said, well, maybe it's me. Maybe that's the reason. You know, I couldn't understand why. But we never really got into a conversation about our loss.
Every year, the Crowthers hold a memorial concert for their son, Wells. In 2006, they invited Tanya. They asked her to address their friends, family, and people Wells had rescued. But just as she was preparing to speak, Tanya backed out. She asked a friend to talk on her behalf.
At the time, I just felt a very honest and sincere warmth towards her. If I think about it now, I don't have a feeling about it. I really don't. You know, something that I did at the time, which made sense and was, you know, emotionally and spiritually the right thing to do. I'm not going to vet everyone who comes along and says, oh, I was there. I'm not going to, you know, do diligence on every one of them. You know, if they come with the, you know, what appears to be a pretty credible curriculum vitae, fine. I believe them.
Up to now, everyone had taken Tanya on face value. On the 7th of September 2006, the New York Daily News ran an article telling the tale of Tanya's extraordinary escape from the 78th floor, the first time it had been written up in full. For most readers, it was a feel-good piece. But the journalists at the New York Times were puzzled. They'd already interviewed all the survivors from that floor. So who was this woman?
A reporter actually called me. He said, you know, we're doing a story on Tanya. I said, well, that's nice. And I just assumed it was had something to do with the anniversary that was coming up, and or had just passed, actually. And her story and so forth, you know, she was president of the Survivors Network. It seemed all very logical. Yeah. When he started asking the questions, though, it became obvious after a couple of minutes that it wasn't, that it was an investigation. He was asking me a lot about what she had told me about her story, a lot of details. You know, none of this seemed to be for a story that was going to be just about her and her experience.
He was asking me if I'd ever been to her apartment. Did she say that Dave was her fiancé? Things that you wouldn't necessarily ask if you believed somebody's story. And we're just doing a regular article about maybe the good things that they had done. He was asking, you know, specific questions. Had I ever seen a picture? Had I ever heard her say that they were engaged and things like that?
They wanted to do a story on Tanya, had a nice story about the successes and all the wonderful things she'd been doing and head of this and head of that and, you know, how positively she turned around her terrible experience. He said, but there are just a few details that we can't, you know, just a few facts we can't seem quite to get.
Some discrepancies.
Yeah, he said, so maybe you could help us out. I said, well, I don't know that much about her, really, other than, you know, what she's told us, but I'll try. And so he said, well, what was her husband's name? I said, you mean she wouldn't tell you that?
She emailed me, these reporters are out to get me. Please don't share any information about me publicly. And I responded that I have nothing to hide about the Survivors Network, and I'm going to answer their questions. And there was one other exchange that I can't recall after that, where she was saying, fine, you know, I know you don't want to hide anything, but just don't say anything about me. And I said, I responded, I'm going to answer their questions. It would seem that you need to talk with them. Because at that point, she was refusing to talk with him. You know, that was the last contact I've had with her.
A week later, the New York Times ran a front-page story on Tanya. Every aspect of her story was called into question. Tanya Head was exposed as a fraud. Her hoax stunned America and much of the world. But for one woman in Brooklyn, it came as a surprising relief.
Now I understood the avoidance. It was like tremendous. The weight was like, wow, lifted. It wasn't me. All the time I thought it was me. I was the problem. That way, maybe because I was a postal person and maybe I wasn't there in the tower. You know, I was just an outside person, so I was not considered part of the team. And here now, it was like, wow, it was all a fake with her.
Deception and lying. A woman who said she was a survivor of 9/11. She even met with then New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. It turns out it was all a lie.
I was on the South Tower, and I lost my fiancé that day.
Can we talk to you for a minute?
Neither Head nor her lawyer are talking. There is no evidence Head ever made money off her story, but she did make herself famous.
It became embarrassing. We'd been taken. Confusing, extremely confusing. And many of us wanted to protect her still and couldn't believe it. And, you know, and there was that whole disbelief also that this can't be happening.
I wasn't really angry with her. She's a raving lunatic. She made up this story, and I knew immediately why she would do it. You know, for the notoriety and for the attention.
As the news broke around the world, every aspect of Tanya's story was exposed as a lie. She didn't work in banking or have an office at the World Trade Center. her fiancé Dave's family had never even heard of her. Then, Spanish national newspaper La Vanguardia discovered that just 10 days after 9/11, when Tania claimed to be in hospital with first-degree burns, she was actually enrolling at business school in Barcelona.
I've talked with more than 20 people attending her class that same day. All of them remember Tania being there. And nobody remembers Tania saying anything about September 11. That would have been the first thing for her to say. But she didn't mention 9/11 at all to anybody. And of course, she didn't show any injuries at all.
Tania's real name was Alicia Esteve Head, and her background provided another shock. Tania, or Alicia, was from a well-connected Spanish family. She'd even attended Swiss finishing school. Genuine survivors were horrified to discover that Tania wasn't even a US citizen. She'd taken a plane and crossed the Atlantic to live out her fantastic lie. But it turned out she'd been in the public eye before. Almost a decade earlier, when Tania was still a young student, her family had been headline news for months. Her father and brother had ended up in jail for their part in a massive 24 million euro state fraud.
Her friends think that she never recovered really from that. So he was trying to be accepted by the group, and she tried so hard to be accepted and to be loved, that she was willing to do anything to achieve this love.
Tania learned to get the approval she longed for simply by lying. Even the damaged arm that was so useful in her 9/11 hoax had featured in an earlier lie.
The story was that she had a car accident. What kind of car accident? Oh, I was driving my Ferrari with my boyfriend, and you know, it was we went really fast, and we just jumped out of the road. She told other people that she had an injury while riding horses at the Polo Country Club in Barcelona. She never owned any horse. She was a very good actress, because with all these lies, she never, or at least I've never found nobody telling me I didn't believe her.
My theory, and this is something I've developed just myself, and I have no basis in fact upon which to ground it, but it would appear to me that she is an individual with a low self-esteem, very low self-esteem. If you've seen pictures of her, you see a short, heavy-set woman, not one would consider to be, or at least I wouldn't consider to be, don't tap me on the leg, dear, I'm going with this. Not what one would consider to be a particularly attractive individual from sort of normal standards.
But that's not how we judge people.
No, I mean, dear, of course not. But this is part of my theory. And that she feels, she felt that she needed to do something to create a different Tania.
She'd created Tania Head so well. She'd lived her fictitious life for 5 years without serious questioning. What amazed everyone was how completely she'd built this new identity.
There's a point in our lives when our childhood dreams of touching the stars give way to reality. We realize that our dreams,
of being a supermodel or becoming a famous athlete, well, it's never going to happen.
That's when you decide
to make the best out of what you have. For a tiny moment there, we all achieve complete happiness. At that rare instant, we accept ourselves for who we are and we are satisfied. Suddenly, life is no longer about what you have, it becomes about what you don't have. And that, my friend, sets us off into our search for the stars. It's such bullshit. I mean, I don't know. I mean, now I look at it and I just go, wow, it's amazing. She constructed a very large narrative, a big, big story, you know, and then I guess doled it out in pieces.
There's a violence to it, and it's amoral, possibly immoral to do what was done, but I wouldn't call it sacrilegious. It's taking advantage of people. Again, if everything is as it seems, you know, it's taking advantage of people. And if you take advantage of particularly vulnerable people, that's probably even worse.
But Tanya hadn't committed any crime under American law. Speaking through her lawyers, Tanya Head declined to be interviewed for this film. Her exact whereabouts are unknown.
I'm very torn. She did a lot of good for our organization, and to have all of that discredited is a hard thing to discredit at all. I mean, she still did good for our organization, but she didn't have to lie. She could have done those things without labeling herself as something she wasn't.
It seems Tanya or Alicia simply packed her bags and left New York. She was free to leave the truth behind.
I think if Tanya had asked me to trade, I would have traded with her. I would have loved her to have my suffering and my pain, and I can have her life.
In February 2008, an email was sent to the Survivors Network from a Spanish account. It claimed Tanya Head had committed suicide. It could be just one more story. No one knows for sure